I don't do no more. The things I used to do, I don't do no more. The things I used to do, I don't do no more. For the Lord's made a change in me.
Hello, this is Real History. I am Melissa, and today, the day that this goes up is the 27th of June. It is actually the 24th. I am here today with John Euler, and I am also on camera, which I never do, and the idea was really so that we could share a screen and show some things, and we'll see how that goes, but I'm going to just snap over here to John's bio and make a little bit of an introduction. I am excited to be talking to John today because I've mentioned him a few times and actually linked to a couple of his things in the past. He was brought to my attention by Neil Foster, and then also in a podcast that I did with Neil and Paul, who, you know, is Angry North, the singer. And the context of sharing his work was under what he does in the transgender movement or countering the transgender movement. He has a website, which I've shared with you before, called unmaskingthetransmovement.com. And so just briefly, I wanted to say that John is a licensed professional counselor. He's a certified clinical trauma professional, a certified sex offender treatment provider, and he is forensically certified in the Hare Psychopathy Checklist. Now, that Hare Psychopathy Checklist, we won't go too much into that unless John wants to go there, but it was a Canadian psychologist, I believe, back in the 70s, who designed a checklist. How do you know, how do you determine if someone that you're working with is a psychopath? And as you all know that have been listening to Alan Watt for a long time, he's talked a lot about psychopaths. What is a psychopath? How do you recognize them? And he's talked about the so-called elite, the intergenerational. Sorry, I'm not used to being on camera, so I'm all squirmy and I don't even know where the camera is. But
listen, just so you know, on my end, I can't see you, so I don't know if it's actually, which is still fine. I don't know if it's actually then recording your visual. You may or may not be on.
Okay, so how is that now that I quit squirming? And do you have a visual of me?
I do not, but that's okay.
Huh?
We've had a lot of problems, so we'll assume that the.
Yes, we have. We have had a lot of problems.
As long as it's fine on your end, I'm absolutely fine on my end.
Okay, so now that I've announced to people that they're seeing me, you may not be seeing me. John and I have discussed what this is, but there are when you're in a certain type of dealing with, let's just call it what it is, evil, you get your fair share of problems that come your way. And a lot of them are technology.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So anyway, so here we go. John, go ahead and dive in and tell us a little bit about yourself. And I'm not going to worry about camera.
There we go. We'll just, you know, we'll go for it. Now, I very much appreciate, Melissa, the opportunity to be on with you, and hopefully this will be an informative time for people that are listening, because I've learned a lot over the years. Didn't intend to really understand as much as I understand now about psychopaths and the process of psychopathy, and that's going to be very controversial. That's okay. I know what I know. You know, when you study psychopaths, the question is, how do you do that and where do you do that? And academic researchers, there's nothing wrong with academic research. That's usually how it's done because it takes a lot of time. But if someone is in the world of academia, I worked for Geneva College for 8 years as an adjunct professor, so I am familiar with academia. But if you're going to deal with a forensic population, The reason I reference that, that means justice involved, those involved have been in prison, essentially, or been in trouble with the law. That's usually where you're going to find those test subjects that you can interview. Either that, well, there we go. Either that, or you take out an ad in the paper and say, hey, we're studying psychopaths, we're looking for volunteers. Right. And the thing about that is, who's going to admit it? And secondly, psychopaths actually would not be interested, because an actual psychopath is not interested in the topic. James Fallon, who has done a nice job helping people understand about psychopathy, his claim to fame is that he scanned his brain inadvertently. He had a lab. They did forensic analysis on the brains of psychopaths, but they also were using their lab for other purposes. I think he's out of UC Irvine now. They were doing a test on, or a series of tests on, Alzheimer's patients. So in their lab, they had two separate tests going on with a lot of different scans. And according to James Fallon, he was straightening up those piles, those separate piles, and he looked at one scan, and it was a psychopath, the brain scan. So he was going to put it in the other pile, and he peeled back the name, and it was him. And so that's how turns out he has a psychopath's brain. So he's written on that, and people are very interested. I have on my program, Journey to Healing, which is a counseling program. It's a podcast weekly. I have referenced that as you watch people watch him. So if he's on, it's usually a live audience that he's in front of. Everybody is leaning forward. Everybody's very interested, because when do you get the chance to hear a non-incarcerated psychopath, other than in politics, and we'll get to that, right? So they're all leaning forward. And what I suggest people do is kind of sit back. If need be, just close your eyes so you're not too fascinated, or forget that he scanned his own brain, and just listen to him talk, especially when he describes his interactions with people and his own interactions with his own family members. And what you'll find is you're listening to a guy that could be around our kitchen table, or, you know, or Thanksgiving table, Christmas table, that we all know one. And for instance, one time he said his kids don't really like to play board games with him. And somebody said, why? He said, well, I always have to win. Uh-huh. Well, how many dads do I need to try to coach, so to speak, in allowing games with their kids to be enjoyable rather than wanting to win? Mm-hmm. That's a significant amount of men. Mm-hmm. So what I suggest is, based upon the men that I've worked with, so I began working in the prison system in 2005 in the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections on psychology staff. I was hired to start the nation's first, as far as the U.S., the nation's first intensive treatment program in long-term solitary confinement. So it had never been done before. I didn't know that. I knew I was tasked with doing something probably pretty unique, but it had never been done before. And through that, I accrued more clinical contact hours, meaning as working with the guys, than any other prison psychology staff member in the U.S. or Canada. So I've spent more time with psychopaths than anybody. And therefore, you can study populations one of two ways. You sit down and you kind of interview them, maybe for a couple of hours, then go back and derive some from that data, try to derive some meaningful things. So a face-to-face interview, or you do a quantitative, which is, you know, 4 out of 5 dentists recommend Crest. So you're going to find out what do psychopaths do. Or you're going to do what's called an embedded field study. Now, I worked there, but Bessel van der Kolk, in the field of trauma, he used his own hospital when he was early in looking at different aspects of research. So it's unique. It's a unique opportunity. If you can actually do research where you are fully employed, because then you don't need to get a grant either. So you're embedded in there. So the best way to study psychopaths is really embed yourself in there, because it's rare that you're going to catch a psychopath off guard. That's one of the characteristics. So the common prevailing view, there's really three views about psychopaths. They're either born, so you have nature, or they're raised, something happened, nurture, or genetics. And there's also issues within the brain, and they've looked at studies, and I've actually spoken about the differences in the brain. A guy from Stanford really did a nice job, and I was able to do a podcast with him, Catherine, on kind of springboarding off of what they found, that there's different structures within the brain now that are very different. And the way to understand, in my estimation, the best way to understand psychopathy, it is not nature, nurture, or genetics. It's certainly brain structure, but the question is, how does one become that way? And unless you can take a series of films over the course of somebody's lifetime, or start when they're in utero, or start right upon birth, then what you have oftentimes is you've scanned somebody's brain and you have a still picture or an actual moving scan. At a certain point in time, by the time they come to your attention, the question is, were they always that way? That's where theory comes in. No one has proven through longitudinal assessment that, oh, this person was always that way. My contention is this, that psychopaths are made, and they are made due to transgressing their own conscience. There are three characteristics of a psychopath and two categories or two populations of psychopaths. There are two populations of psychopaths. By the way, this will hopefully be helpful. When I heard the term psychopath, my mind probably went where most of our minds go, the bloody psychopath, the horror films. And that's true. That's certainly that's a big part of that. But actually, my contention is that's fewer than the norm. And the norm is what Robert Hare called the white-collar psychopath. So the bloody psychopath comes to our attention because of the dramatic way in which he comes to our attention. He's the serial killer. He's the one that has bloody body counts, or a bloody body count. But the white-collar psychopath, so Robert Hare coined that term, as he said, if he hadn't studied psychopaths in prison, he actually didn't necessarily work in a prison. He had them brought out to him. He had a mobile scan set outside the prison. But he said if he hadn't worked in prison with psychopaths, he would have studied them, as far as working, studied them in on Wall Street. Well, let that sink in. His contention is psychopaths are few and far between, because his criteria focuses on the impulsive kind. And that kind of hit me. I went through the training. The DOC flew him in. And I actually did very well in the training. But I noticed in the criteria of the PCLR, it focuses on, and so in my own chart that I've recently designed, I separate out the impulsive from the non-impulsive kind. And my contention is there are far more self-controlled, non-impulsive, it's almost redundant, very methodical psychopaths than there are impulsive ones. And the non-impulsive kind don't get busted as easily, especially if we're talking about sophisticated ones. So where do we find those? And let me give you two populations. Sorry, I digress for a second. The two categories are bloody versus white-collar psychopath. And then the question, question is, what is the definition of a psychopath? So we have two populations of psychopaths. And the working definition is this. It comes down to three things that are found in both populations. Lack of conscience, lack of remorse, and lack of empathy. Meaning, to the extent that you override your conscience, so again, my contention is a psychopath is neither nature, nurture, or genetics. They are made. How? You violate your conscience long enough. If any of us violate our conscience long enough, guess what we'll do? We'll be successful at it. Then what are we capable of doing? Well, as goes conscience, so goes your remorse. So if I override conscience long enough, guess what? I won't be sorry for what I do, and I won't be sorry for the impact it has on you. And now what am I likely to do? I'm likely to run for political office. And think about it this, they are masters of impression management, meaning they can manage the impression you have of them. And if they are self-controlled, you'll never know it. Why? Because they don't stand out. And my contention also is this, that for the sophisticated psychopaths, the further into psychopathy they go, the less abnormal they look, because they're actually more polished. So they appear ever more normal. That's why we find them in significant numbers in politics, in finance, in sales. I also contend that a sociopath and a psychopath are different. Sociopath is all about sales. It's all about getting what you can. But once boundaries are set, a sociopath won't really push them. They'll move on. Why? It's not worth the effort, because for a sociopath, it is cost benefit analysis. Once the cost outweighs the benefit, they'll move on. Think about when you go to buy a vehicle, you drive onto a car lot, you're being profiled already by all the car salesmen, and they come out and you watch how a car salesman works a prospect, and he's analyzing them. He doesn't really care about them, but he's smiling at them. What is the end game? What's the goal for the sociopath? It's all about upselling someone and making sure they like the process to where they're going to give them a five-star rating, even though they were upsold into a vehicle with all the bells and whistles that they can't afford. Doesn't matter, let alone the possibility of being sold a lemon, but let's say on a new car lot. So the salesperson in car sales, doesn't matter, any kind of sales. Now, this sounds funny, it's not a pejorative term in a way. It is what it is. Most of us understand if we are approached by a salesperson, if you go to an upscale clothing store in the U.S., Nordstrom's or Saks Fifth Avenue, right? What are they doing? They're sizing you up, pardon the pun, and they're going to try to upsell you if you go into a restaurant, as a matter of fact. Even if you are overweight and you have diabetes, maybe they know or don't know. Guess what the server is going to try to do? They're going to try to upsell you. They know they fed you well, and now they offer what at the end? Hey, would you like to see the dessert menu? Why did they do that?
A wafer thin mint.
That's exactly right. And so why are they doing that? Because at the end of the day, and the monthly report for a restaurant will show who is the highest producer as far as the server. And there's a lot of emphasis for servers on serving alcohol. And so it's trying to upsell. Well, who does that? Salesperson. A little fancy term, sociopath, right? So a sociopath is all about sales, and the better they are, meaning the smoother they are, and the smoothest are the ones that will get what they want, and you'll actually smile. You'll think they looked out for your best interest, and you'll give them afterward a five-star rating, and you'll recommend to your neighbors that they go there because they had a wonderful, purchasing experience. Okay. Now, do you really think the person cares about you? No, they were just really adept at sales. As a matter of fact, the best car salesmen, do you know they can change brands? They can sell Volkswagen, then they can sell Audis, then they can sell Rolls Royces. And they don't really care. It's all about moving units. So they're very flexible, very adaptable. A psychopath is one that has continued to allow, and here's a key factor, continued to allow ego to grow.
Yes.
So the thing that keeps ego within each of us, the thing that keeps ego in check, is our conscience. Right? Ego will grow like a snowball. There's something about each human being. We see it with the little angelic baby that comes into the world. We all love babies, but it's only a matter of time till kids reach about age two, and we call it the terrible twos. Well, what happened to our little angelic creature? Because our little angelic baby became a two-year-old. And now why do they call it terrible twos? Same child, just 2 years later. Mm-hmm. We're seeing human nature. human nature in that little two-year-old will look up to the primary people in his or her life, ideally the parents that care, would lay their lives down, who are setting boundaries for that child's best interest. And that little child looks up at parents that are five times, six times its size, and will have the temerity to say what? No. Okay, where does it, the parents didn't teach them that. And this is the world over. Wherever you go around the world, every parent understands the terrible twos. Where, what happened to our little angelic baby? Human nature kicked in. From a biblical perspective, it's called sin nature. There's something within fallen humanity that raises a clenched fist and raises a middle finger to authority, saying, nobody's going to tell me what to do. Mm-hmm. And so we have to, ideally as parents, we break the will without breaking the spirit in a child, in child training. So we want to rein in the willfulness, because what happens if you don't do that? Well, as they're growing up, we call it a spoiled child. What do we call it as an adult? We call it a criminal. We call it a criminal mind. We call it someone that's going to come together in groups of people and burn down statues and buildings and take over Portland, Oregon and Seattle, Washington and destroy great cities. That's the human heart. It's self-entitled. So if that is not put in check, it will grow. We all know that. We all know kids that we're looking at the parents like child-centered parenting. What can we predict with that? A problem, especially when they become teenagers. So unless a parent helps, really helps civilize a child, right? Helps a child begin to understand they're not the center of the universe, that all the toys in the sandbox are not theirs. Little Johnny, we brought your toys. Little Susie's over there playing nice. Now we're going to help socialize. We do social skills. Why do we have to teach social skills? Because we down inside are barbarians. The book and film Lord of the Flies, right, talks about what happens when young people, any of us, are left to ourselves. So there's something within us that is uniquely selfish, and that needs to be kept in check.
There's something that I wanted to mention about an interview that you did. I mentioned it to you about psychopathy. And you touched on a chart, which I'd like you to bring up in a little bit, but you touched on a chart that showed ignoring conscience in pair, it kind of in tandem with the psychopathic traits that would develop. As you know, the more that you ignore your conscience as the guide, the more that the psychopathic traits develop. And Alan pointed out to his listeners for many, many years that we live in a culture that is increasingly psychopathic. So that the people, and you want to say, and human nature wants to say, they, them, those bad people are doing something to us. Those, that cabal, the ruling elite, whatever. His antidote is look in the mirror. Why is that the antidote? Because the traits that make a culture psychopathic are the traits that we allow to grow within ourselves. And when I heard you talking to Sean, it was Sean McCann, and I'll link to that interview because I thought you raised some really good points there. It reminded me of, I'm a reader, and I had a relationship many, many years ago with someone who was an alcoholic. I read the big book of AA, and there were several things that I didn't really understand about 12-step programs. If I get that you're saying that you need God. I mean, that was the first thing. He was going to his old drunken buddy and saying, I used to be like you, and then I have this relationship with God, and that changed me, and here's what I did. But my key takeaway from reading that book was that he said, essentially, we are selfish people. Self-centeredness. Now, this is what this is classic AA, if you go there, you know. We are self-centered, and we think that our problems are self-will run riot, our self-centeredness. And I thought, over time, and I'm not licensed to do anything, I don't give anybody advice on that, but over time, I've developed my own ideas about the addictive personality. Someone who drinks too much, someone who uses drugs, an addict. They're selfish.
Well, actually, let me qualify that. Yes, absolutely. And that's why step four has to be there. They took a searching and fearless moral inventory.
That's right.
Overriding conscience. The real question, though, in order to truly help an addict is to figure out, they have to stop because what they're doing is now negatively impacting other people. The question is, how did it start? So you can have two addicts, one that started purely out of selfishness, they just wanted to start using, or somebody that started to self-anesthetize to deal with pain. Yeah. Two different populations, but ultimately they still have to come to the same point. So to your point, it's not until somebody deals with their selfishness. So we're not responsible for what we're given, but we're responsible for what we do with it. So the notion of hurt people, I'm okay with that for one day. But then beyond that, if I know I'm hurting somebody, what do I do about that? Do I continue to spread the love and spread the pain, so to speak? So it really does matter. At the end of the day, the focus has to be, it's no longer about me. In humility, I have to come to terms with the fact I've been hurtful. Once somebody is there, so conscience is kicking back. So both populations have overridden conscience. After that, though, in order within treatment, so to speak, in my estimation, it really does matter then where did that come from. When we're talking about psychopaths, they were never wounded. Now, let me qualify that because you do have wounded kids that grow into psychopaths. Those will be the impulsive ones. The ones I'm most concerned about are the sophisticated ones, especially the sophisticated sexual psychopaths. They were never perped on.
Right.
And so that's important for the audience to understand because those will be the ones that will actually volunteer for the study. So once they're busted or as a preemptive strike, so to speak, a defensive measure, those are going to be the ones to allow themselves to be interviewed by academic researchers. And so, for instance, I just thought of Kinsey. So you'll have two groups of people that are very interested in ensuring that penalties are decreased. So the psychopaths are the ones that will strategize how to ensure that once they are busted, they do very little prison time. So Kinsey was as deviant as the day is long. And so why did he do what he did? Ultimately to impact and to dumb down the criminal penalties on sex offenses. That's what he was used for. The CIA actually funded him. I was good friends with, became good friends with Judith Riesman just shortly before her death. She and I had begun working together collaboratively for a couple of years. And she was one to really help me understand the funding that went into Kinsey and the Rockefeller Foundation and all that.
Ellen's listeners are very familiar with her. And I was excited to hear you mention that in the Sean McCann interview, that he has mentioned her work exposing what a deviant Kinsey was and who funded him.
There you go. How do you change a culture? Right? Mm-hmm. So for as far as selfishness, sorry, I digressed a little bit, but it really is important for people to understand that whenever somebody is doing something that negatively impacts somebody, they're overriding conscience.
Right.
For those that started out being wounded, then eventually morphed into somebody that was becoming hurtful, they still have to attend to conscience, but then they'll be able to, meaning they have to stop. And that's where the 12 steps come in for them. They need to stop, but then they also need to look at what happened. How did that get going? So that would be an addict that started to numb out, wanted to self-anesthetize. But then you have a portion of that population of addicts that really was never wounded. It was just self-entitlement, and they really didn't care to whatever extent they were harming someone. And so they themselves, again, were overriding conscience. Mm-hmm. So it still comes back to, and to your point, it comes back to conscience. There is selfishness, and until any of us deal with our selfishness, our ego is going to grow. So selfishness, or ego and selfishness are one and the same, really.
Yeah. That's a good point. I like that.
So what I can do, actually, what I was thinking is I'll show you a chart that will really set the stage for help people understand than the other chart. Chart on dealing with human nature. Let me see if I can screen share here. And hopefully this will be helpful for people. I use this. I don't know if it came up on my end.
I see it.
Can you see it on your end?
Okay. I can see it on my end.
I don't see it on my end, so I'll just kind of walk you through. What you're looking at is really a collection of terms, words that are from the book of Proverbs and Psalms. And so you're looking at very much a Judeo-Christian perspective, but again, looking at Psalms and Proverbs, a way to formulate or a way to understand what I believe every Jew understood even 2,000 years ago, that they understood there was the way of wisdom, there is the path, there is the life. For instance, in Proverbs chapter 3, verses 5 and 6, it says, trust the Lord with all your heart. Don't lean on your own understanding in all your ways. Acknowledge him and he'll direct your path. There's the way of the Lord. That's the most often used analogy that God in Scripture would reference. So he told his people, there's a way. I set before you two paths, path of life, path of death. Choose life. So there is a way of life that stays within the boundaries, and the Ten Commandments lays out a very basic structure as far as how we can treat other people properly. Someone who's walking in wisdom is someone that is walking in a way that will treat other people how God wants them to be treated. So God has a high view of people and a low view of things. Things are here to be used for our benefit. When I start to get into selfishness, what happens is I cross the boundaries and I start to go down the slippery slope. And there are categories that somebody can transition through. Things will pick up like a snowball, and at the top of the chart, you will see how God responds. And so I recommend to people, check out this chart, take a screenshot of it, and begin to look at the book of Proverbs and Psalms, and what you will see is God consistently responds to people based upon which category they are in. As a matter of fact, let me see if I can bring up, it's a little challenging here because I don't know, let me stop sharing here.
Okay, that's okay. I'm also going to just interject here for the audience of listeners who come from a lot of different backgrounds. There's something I want to say here. No matter where you are or where you're coming from or what you think about religion or the idea of religion or God or the Bible, if you can't take wisdom where it's found, you might want to ask yourself why. So we're looking at Proverbs and Psalms, and there is wisdom there. Whether you agree with the historicity of it or believe in God or don't. So let's just look at some wisdom.
Okay, now let me bring back. So am I still sharing this?
Yes, I see it.
Okay, what I want to do now, if I can. Okay, let me stop sharing for just a moment.
Okay.
Stop sharing, and I'll bring up then another version of it. Now, for those that, and I work with a lot of guys throughout the week on a weekly basis, and they come from various backgrounds. But what's interesting is this, psychology really is pretty late in the game. I'm going to go with something that's time-tested for 3,000 years. Every
right.
culture around the world has this sense of, has an idea of the straight and narrow. They understand that. As a matter of fact, most kids growing up, they heard something like this as they were heading to school. Maybe a parent says, okay, be good. what are they referencing? Be good, right? What they're saying is don't screw up. Don't do something wrong. Okay, what they're saying is this: stay on the right path. Mm-hmm. Okay, we say we got to mind our P's and Q's. That was actually pints and quarts, but it means, right, I got to stay on the straight and narrow. We do well when we stay on the straight and narrow. Universally, every culture has that concept. What is that based upon? Ultimately, it's based upon how I treat other people. And in what way? Ultimately, boundaries. To the extent that I recognize other people's boundaries is the extent to which I'm going to keep myself in check. What you now have is an overlay from that same chart, what I call the subcategories. Now, at the end of the book of Proverbs, and this is all to set the stage for the chart that I created on psychopathy, because my contention is this. The new term, relatively new term, psychopathy or psychopath, is equivalent to the old-fashioned 3,000-year-old term found in the book of Proverbs of a fool. If you read through scripture, a fool is not a minor category. It's not like we hear these days one guy saying, man, you're an old fool. Or no, to be a fool, according to the book of Proverbs or Psalms, meaning you were past the point of no return in terms of selfishness, says this: the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Well, does he have to say it out loud? No, Judas never said it out loud, but trust me, he was king of his own castle. He would make the rules. So when I get to a point when in my heart of hearts, I ain't listening to anybody, and I am fine with that. And as a matter of fact, if I then go on to believe that if everybody would just listen to me and get out of my way, we would all cooperate, and then everything would be fine. What am I, who am I describing? A selfish person in anybody's family, quite frankly. Okay, so the idea that came 3,000 years ago, so I'm going to go with that, to be honest. I'm going to go with time-tested wisdom, and the Proverbs is called the Book of Wisdom. So if somebody has a problem with this, I'll tell you exactly why you have a problem with this, because now I'm showing you you. Now, so what the principle is this: to the extent that we get off the blue, we're starting to move now into categories. In the green, that can be anyone as far as what their motivation. If someone isn't motivated out of ego, but they're starting to disregard things, now they're slipping. If they're allowing selfishness to grow, we all do that. So ideally, as we get into the green, look at how God feels about that. What's nice is he doesn't zap us. He tries to get us back on the blue, because walking on the way of wisdom, things will go well with us. But what happens if we are nudged? How does God nudge us? Through our conscience. What happens if we start to kind of ignore our conscience? Let's say we decided to kind of dump a knapsack, so to speak. And a knapsack is representative of us doing what is right, just, and fair. That comes out of Proverbs chapter 1 and chapter 2. That is our responsibility. Now, certainly paying the bills, all that is our responsibility. But how about what comes out of our mouth? How about the words we use? How about our attitude? We are called to do what is right, just, and fair. Fair takes into account context. So what happens if one day I am not very sensitive to my spouse or my kids? I say something in the morning which I shouldn't have said, and now I leave, and they're sort of happy to have me go, right? Or everybody breathes a sigh of relief, but that's sad, right? What happens if a family devolves into they can't wait for somebody to go to work so they can breathe easy? We have an issue then in that home. So ideally then I get in the car, I drive off. Now my conscience is going to do its thing. What? It's going to let me know, you know, John, you shouldn't have said that. Well, what should I do? I should place a call to home, pick up my cell phone, you know, safely make a call and apologize. What happens if I don't do that? Well, throughout the day, I should be bothered. What happens if I'm not bothered? I come home. Now we've got a little elephant in the middle of the room. Am I going to address that, or am I going to ignore it? If I ignore it, why am I ignoring it? For whose benefit? Me. And so now I'm starting to allow a new normal. I'm starting to allow a new baseline. What kind of baseline? I'm off the path. And now it's like minus one. So I'm into a category that's gone from green to now the beginning of yellow. Mm-hmm. And so what you see is there's this first category. These three categories are listed at the end of Proverbs chapter 1. So 3,000 years ago, there was this idea of the slippery slope. and it progresses. And the one thing about that yellow category called the simple or the simpleton is it's very open to others starting to have influence upon it. So if I'm starting to justify and rationalize and go against my conscience, I'm probably going to be a little more quick to complain about things. And who am I going to complain to? People in the blue? No, because they may check me. They may suggest I look at things from a different perspective, maybe even say, well, you know what, all things being equal, John, have you apologized? I don't want to hear that. Who am I going to get together with at the water cooler? Those that are equally at the same level or further down. What I don't realize is the people further down, especially in the red, they are sharks looking to use someone. And so eventually I'm going to probably find myself starting to associate with people that are not only going to normalize and justify what I do, tell me what I want to hear. Those are called me too fools, which is, oh yeah, well, me too. Yeah. Oh, they'll tell me why I'm right. Tell me why I don't have to apologize. But they're actually going to start to feed my ego. Why? Because they're going to have designs for me. Now, not everybody.
Hey, they're fattening up the prey.
There you go. Thank you. Right. And so I use the analogy with some of the guys I work with, different kind of analogy, but let's say they're going to do a drug deal and it's happened or they're en route and they get pulled over. The driver, though, is the most naive. And so let's say I thought these were my friends. And how many times in prison did I hear this? Mr. Eli, I couldn't believe it. I didn't know there were drugs in the car. I didn't know there were weapons, right? So all of them are going to end up in handcuffs in the book of Proverbs at the end of chapter one. All of them are going to be hit with a tsunami, but the force of that tsunami of judgment will vary depending upon the degree, the category somebody is in. So the premise is that if I don't respond properly to my conscience, I will move, I will morph, I will go downhill from one category to the next, and you can see that it's always having to do with conscience. That at first I transgress, and what's going to try to get me back up onto the blue? It's my conscience. But if I start to ignore it, and then I will resist it, look at what starts to happen between me and truth. And then you'll see two categories. One is persecution, because eventually I'll morph into the mocker. What was the mocker? Well, just even feel that term, and you see some of those white circled words. That's from a Hebrew word study. So to become a mocker is somebody who is very actively pushing back and really going against truth and anybody that represents truth. You see the word pigs and dogs. That comes from Matthew chapter 7,
oh,
verse
yeah,
6,
yeah.
Right? And Jesus said this to his audience. It was primarily a Jewish audience. He said this. Don't take what is special. The word hagiazo means like good china. Don't take the best. Don't take your special stuff and give it to dogs. Well, in a third world country, dogs ran the streets in packs. So don't take what is special and give it to those outside the family. Then he said, don't cast your pearls before pigs. Okay, what is a pig? Well, no Jew should have had it, so that would have caught the audience attention. But what is a pig? A pig is, where would you find pigs? Corralled, and you don't see them running the streets. That would be a herd of, wild boars, which is an oxymoron.
Right.
You don't see a bunch of wild boars coming down the street. You see the dogs. So I believe what Jesus is talking about is whether outside the family or inside the family, we have to discern, because then he added this. He said, because if you take your pearls, what are pearls? Your time, effort, energy, and resources. We are stewards of that which has been entrusted to us. And we only have so much time, effort, energy, and resource. If we give them to the wrong person, if I can't figure out these categories, then I will spend my time, my effort, my energy, my resources on the wrong kind of people. And Jesus said, as far as even within the mocker category, they will trample your pearls. So you're taking what is important. You're taking your time. Mm-hmm. You're giving your effort, energy, resources. You're giving money. They won't appreciate it. They're going to trample it. They treat it in a casual fashion. It'll never be enough. And then that's bad enough. That's already insult. But now they're going to add injury to insult. If you turn the spigot off on your pearls, then they'll turn on you and consume you. Mm-hmm. So what used to be a favor now became an expectation. And so that's at just the mocker category. He says, don't do it.
There's something else about the pigs and dogs, too, in the Bible that I think is worth mentioning here. When, let's say, the demons have been cast out, or what is bad in you, you have removed, if you aren't filling that up with the right sustenance, then it is said that you will return to your bad ways as the pig does to its muck or the dog to its vomit. What does a dog do when it vomits? It goes back and sniffs it. It might even eat it. So you have to not only, you know, get yourself on the narrow path, quit being selfish, you know, come back. You must continue that on a day-to-day, moment-by-moment, or guess what? You're going to be wallowing in your muck again and eating your own vomit.
There you go. And you will continue to do harm to other people.
That's right.
Right? And the smarter you are, the less overt it will be. And eventually, it will be more and more all about you and less about other people. What do we call that? A dysfunctional home at best. What is a dysfunctional family? It is one that is tension-reducing, but never tension-resolving. And it really has to do with there's a black hole, emotional black hole, somebody who is in that family that it all revolves around them and everybody has to tippy-toe around them lest they trip over the elephant in the middle of the room because the stuff was swept under the carpet and now becomes a landmine waiting to be stepped on. Everybody was walking on eggshells. This is exactly, we come back to the 12 steps, that an alcoholic home or any kind of dysfunctional home is one in which there's something there, everybody knows it, but everybody's pacifying or enabling or rescuing the selfish person. Nobody's speaking truth. So ego will silence truth. And what you see is right in the middle of the chart, kind of where it morphs from, where we have somebody that's morphed into a strong persecutor into oppression. That there's a difference biblically between those two concepts. Jesus said, love your enemies. There were three different words for enemies. He chose one of those because that word enemy has to do with, it's called Paneros. Paneros had to do with somebody that goes against truth. They want somebody who represents truth to shut their mouth. Once they shut their mouth, the tension will stop. So that's true persecution. If somebody's familiar with the Apostle Paul, he said he was eligible for forgiveness. He was not a nice guy, but he was right in that kind of the early orange category. He was going against truth. He was rounding people up, putting them in prison. He was doing harm to people. But the question is, was he eligible for forgiveness? He said yes, because he did it out of ignorance. He thought what he was doing was he was upholding what God wanted him to do, but he still was doing bad things. So if you've been on the receiving end of persecution, somebody that persecutes somebody can chop somebody's head off for persecution. In the book of Revelation, they talk about the martyred saints, but there's two different kinds of people that can chop somebody's head off. Somebody that is a persecutor, that believes they're doing what they're doing because God wants them to, or because they don't like truth, versus they want to chop somebody's head off because they want to see them suffer because they like seeing people suffer. Those are two different things. That's an oppressor. So somebody who gets into persecuting other people, it will be because that other person represents truth. But at some point in time, their conscience will stop them from doing something to other people just for the sake of doing it. If someone continues on in terms of morphing into selfishness, they'll get to a point where they actually like hurting people for the sake of hurting people. And also the difference is this, just like the sociopath is all about personal benefit. So within the mocker and getting close to that fool category, it's all what's in it for me. But if somebody continues on in terms of ego, they will get to a point where once boundaries are set, once finally somebody says enough is enough, a sociopath will move on. So a pig and a dog will stop. But a psychopath or a fool, so now we're morphing into the darker red, the red category, they will actually turn on the person for the temerity, for the for the fact that they had the temerity to set boundaries. How dare you stop me? I will now show you. I will punish you. Mm-hmm. So a sociopath will stop at some point in time once the cost outweighs the benefit. A psychopath is all about having the last word, last say, and last laugh. They're all about ensuring that the person understands who they are, who they were setting boundaries against. So
right.
Instead of the snake oil salesman getting out of Dodge, right? So there's our sociopath. He moves on, but he's all self-centered. If somebody comes up to the snake oil salesman and says, you know what, you really shouldn't be ripping other people off, he'll start to mock that person. So he's definitely in the mocker category. But if somebody challenges what they think, the snake oil salesman, if the snake oil salesman is not just a sociopath, but is morphed into a white collar psychopath, he won't get out of Dodge. He'll park his wagon there and he'll start to go after that person. It's now mm-hmm. war, and he'll burn it to the ground and sit on the ashes and feel very satisfied. So qualitatively, there's a big difference once somebody becomes a fool. And so that's why in the book of Proverbs, anytime you see the word fool and what we should do with the fool, it will always reference stay away from the fool, do not give honor to the fool, do not talk to a fool, do not listen to a fool. There should be distance. If you have somebody that's in that category in your life, 100% always, you will only and always invite pain into your life.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because they are well beyond the pig and the dog. And Jesus said, do not cast your pearls before swine. So if you can't discern the difference between a pig and a dog, you certainly aren't going to discern the difference between a sophisticated fool, and you will only be harming yourself. So looking at that chart, you can see there are very few people really that we should be dealing with. So all things being equal, right? So we can save our efforts. There we are. So in looking at that chart, that sets the stage for really all the other charts that I, on different podcasts that I use, but especially the one that we will be looking at in terms of sexual psychopathy. And I'm looking at the time, I have about a half hour left. We'll no doubt have to do a part two.
Melissa, well, I wanted to say that I would like a part two of just this, but I have already arranged with John that because his work is so broad and encompasses so many different areas, that he has generously agreed to come back two more times between now and early September, because I wanted to get into his work unmasking the transgender movement. I also want to touch, I think in September, on the SRA, and people won't know what this is, satanic ritual abuse. And I know I even said I was going to save even saying that for later, because people who, they'll just go, oh, what, you know? Right. But so I there's a lot to get to here, but the psychopathy, to me, this is the starting point for everything, is the psychopath. It's the starting point to understanding how we make our way in the world, why we want to stay on a very narrow path. Because when I was looking at this chart, what I'm thinking is, this is so hard for people in the culture that we're in right now, because everywhere you look, you're going to be told that your worst behaviors, that your most egocentric attitudes and behaviors are good. Yeah. There's going to be television shows about how to score big, you know, how to rack up, sexual conquest. And, you know, our entire culture is geared towards creating and celebrating psychopaths. And so getting on the narrow path means what you just said there is a very valuable piece of wisdom. We should be interacting with very few people.
We better choose wisely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how many marriages how many people were suckered by, we use the term narcissism as well. As a matter of fact, let me bring up one additional chart because I think this will be helpful. Let me find it here. And I actually use all these charts with the guys that I work with. So let me bring this chart up. Hopefully this will help people know. Start sharing. Okay, so here's another way to view this. Okay, we have another concept, another picture of the not only the straight and narrow, but the slippery slope. So what I tell people, what I tell guys that I work with, we're either getting better or worse, better or bitter. We never stay the same. Nobody ever stays the same in terms of character. And what we have in front of you is, in terms of character, we have positive 1 to positive 10. So people are growing in terms of character. So the upper circles, by the way, are who we should have in our life. So you can see there's a decreasing circumference. And so ideally, we want people that are in the 8s, 9s, and 10s. Those will be people who are trustworthy, loyal. Think about the character qualities of a Boy Scout. Trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent. I still can't believe I remember that. I didn't go very far in Boy Scout. Okay, so those are people that will treat you well. Those are people that honor their conscience and would not intend to cross boundaries. Those are people that you can extend grace to. There's 2 elements when it has to do with human relationships. Scripture says that Jesus grew in grace and truth. Those 2 elements are always in play, should always be in play, and will always be in play in human relationships. The question is, who should you extend 1 or the other 2, and in increasing or decreasing amounts? The further up they go into the blue, more grace, less truth if something happens. Because, somebody that has a fully active and working conscience, somebody that has a mind that views people as highest of value, things, they objectify things, right? They use objects as objects, people as people. Those are going to be people that the only time they cross your boundaries is by mistake, and they will self-govern their conscience. They will tend to be the people in our lives that will actually approach us even when we didn't know the other person did something, right? So those are the kind of people we want. Well, John, I'm really sorry and you go, what? I don't remember that. Well, I do, and I wanted you to know I'm sorry. Okay, that's a 9 or 10 kind of person. That's the kind of person you could hand your car keys to, your house key to, your children to, your bank account to, right? That's a person that's never going to betray you, the 9 and the 10. The further down you get, but especially once you get into the negative numbers. So we have our 2 little guys there with the knapsack. That word knapsack is found in the book of Galatians, where Paul says, not just each man should carry his, bear one another's burdens. The Greek word for that is boulder, but what you see on there is a few verses later, each man should carry his own load. So the Greek word in English, we call it load. In the Greek, it was a knapsack like that. And what do those little knapsacks represent? Proverbs chapter 1 and chapter 2, doing what is right, just, and fair. So our responsibility is really our emotional responsibility is to treat each person in a right way, in a fair way, in a just way. You show me a person that is going to always be governed by doing what is right, just, and fair, especially how about their attitude and what comes out of their mouth. You're probably going to have a person that's decent to live with, right? I wouldn't mind, and I am married to someone like that. High school sweetheart, we went our own separate ways. We've been back together now, married 8 years. It's a beautiful thing. Because really, you're then interacting with somebody who is conscientious, thinking about another person. Think about the word conscientious. What does that mean? With conscience. So the kind of person that each of us want to go into business with, that have as a life partner, what we're trying to bring about as parents within our kids is we want them to think about other people. And that's how you teach empathy as well. We can say, oh, buddy, well, no, it's not yours. How would you feel if? So we're instilling within their conscience, correct information, correct truth, so that if they cross boundaries, they are then bothered. Their conscience then will drive them to do the right thing and do what? Take back their knapsack. So the goal is, mm-hmm. as I tell people that I work with, one knapsack, no more, no less. That makes for a healthy relationship. That means both people are doing what is right, just, and fair. We get things out of whack when one has none, when one has no knapsack and the other has two. So in that relationship, that means somebody has dumped their responsibility to do what is right, just, and fair, meaning they're not listening to their conscience. They cross somebody's boundaries, and now it's placed upon somebody else. We can do that in one of two ways. Either I give someone what they don't deserve, so I've had a rotten day, I come home and I dump. It's off of me, but now it's on them. And now we've done a trickle effect because boss dumps on the dad, dad comes home, dumps on the wife, wife dumps on the kid, kid kicks the dog, dog bites the cat, and cat eats the mouse, and the mouse doesn't take the cheese. So it's that trickle-down effect. So until somebody in the family finally says, you know what, the buck stops here. What does that mean? I'm not going to pass the buck. I'm not going to pass my knapsack. So a balanced relationship is one in which people have one knapsack, no more, no less. That is different than helping someone out. What this means is I myself am not going to knowingly dump on somebody else. Again, that happens one of two ways. I give someone what they don't deserve, or I withhold from someone what they do deserve, both of which are oppressive. So let's say somebody deserves a compliment. Somebody works hard or did something nice. They deserve a compliment. For me to withhold that, or how about a husband that says, I told my wife I loved her at the wedding. If anything changes, I'll let her know. It's like, what? That's an oppressive relationship. Right. Withholding love. Right. That's very oppressive. So the idea of oppression goes back to the first chart. Think about the pigs and the dogs in that category. The mocker now moving into the fool. What is characteristic of the fool? He's an oppressor. What is oppression? Me weighing another person down, either overtly or covertly with knapsacks. The more somebody becomes adept at placing knapsacks, now adept in what way? Impression management. Because there's two mechanisms in play, and this will be brought to bear in the chart eventually that we're going to look at. So this is all preliminary to really understand how somebody can become a sexual psychopath. Prior to becoming a sexual psychopath, they have had to master the art of impression management. Meaning, I'll be able to look at someone in the eyes and tell them, well, I know what it looks like, but it's really not that. So I'm looking at porn on the computer. My wife walks in. She says, what are you doing? And what do? At that point, very few men will confess. They turn around and say, what? She says, well, I saw you. No, you didn't. What are you talking about? What am I all of a sudden doing? And whether it's with pornography, whether it's with finance, whether with anything, how about I'm supposed to pick my wife up at a certain time? And I'm letting myself be selfish. And so I arrive late. And she says, honey, nothing personal, but you were supposed to be here at 5. It's now 1:30 in the morning. Let's say I'm at the bar. What's the guy going to say? Well, you didn't tell me that. I didn't know, right? So what's going on? Deflection, justification, rationalization. But somebody who is selfish is not listening to their conscience. Well, there's two mechanisms that God has designed within us since Adam and Eve fell to maintain human relationships, to ensure that knapsacks aren't being placed on each other. So there's two mechanisms within us that will maintain one knapsack, no more, no less. That is conscience and intuition. Conscience will cause me to make sure that I don't place my knapsack on you. So my conscience will drive me to do what is right, just, and fair. But what happens if I get off the path? Now I'm starting to go down from the yellows into the oranges into the reds. So I'm morphing into categories. I'm overriding my conscience. Therefore, I'm now creating a callous effect. I'm now running the risk eventually getting to a point where I harden my heart. I harden my conscience to such an effect, or such an extent, that it no longer works. I've turned the volume down on my conscience. Therefore, it actually starts to become easier and easier. Right in the middle area, I start to become inverted, What used to be right, wrong, good, bad now becomes inverted. Now, instead of loving people, using things, I now will eventually use people and love things along with becoming more and more selfish. There's a lot of dynamics in play. So the challenge is, how are each of us doing with our conscience? Do I have a sensitive conscience, not overly sensitive? Does my conscience work? If it does, then you'll never have to worry about me crossing your boundaries, manipulating you, using you, taking my knapsack, placing on you. But what happens if I get to a point where I care less about you and more about me, meaning I'm selfish, ego is growing? I'm getting that way because I'm overriding conscience. I'm turning the volume down, and so it's becoming easier for me to dump my knapsack on you. As I do that, I'm not bothered by it. So think about a psychopath. What's the definition? The less conscience, the less remorse. So I'm really not sorry. And the less what? The less empathy. I really don't care about the impact it's having on you, because by the time I'm getting worse and worse, how long have I been dumping on you? How long have I been using you and manipulating you? So this happens over time, days, weeks, months, and years. So by the time I override my conscience, there's nothing left on my end to stop me from dumping my knapsack on you, from crossing your boundaries. Mm-hmm. So if I'm less and less inclined to stop myself, what's the only thing left to prevent me from crossing your boundaries and dumping my knapsack? All the same concept. So if I'm no longer listening to my conscience, what is to keep me from hopping the fence that divides our property lines?
That is the other person's intuition.
There we go.
And just going back to impression management that you talked about, the impression management, let me see if I get this right, that's gaslighting.
100%. Or it's going to be, I'm going to make sure that how you perceive me is exactly how I want you to perceive me.
Right.
And the gaslighting is an excellent way. So I can do one of two things. I can gaslight, which is more, I'm tearing someone down. That's easier. So a low level sophisticated psychopath is going to do that. But they run the risk of somebody finding out. So the most sophisticated psychopaths will never gaslight you. They will actually play mind games with you to where you actually want to be around them. So somebody who's been gaslit doesn't like their, let's say the spouse is doing that. They hate it when their spouse is home. That's one degree of narcissism. My contention is you have to become a narcissist first, in order to become a sociopath and then eventually a psychopath. Why? A narcissist simply is an emotional black hole. It's all about them. But you can have a simple narcissist. That's the kind of person, kind of like what we're talking about, which is the person that nobody can stand being around. You roll your eyes when they come in the room. Why? Because everybody knows they're a narcissist. The narcissist that likes to look at themselves in the mirror, that's a very, very superficial narcissist. The other is the malignant narcissist, but nobody likes to be around them, but you can't leave them per se. That doesn't take a lot of finesse. It just takes a little bit of strategy, meaning I'm gaslighting my wife at home and even in the car to church. But as soon as we get out of the car to walk into church, right? Now we've got a secret that it's dependent upon other people. Going along with it, keeping it, but mm-hmm. little do mm-hmm. they know what's going on behind closed doors. If they could only right. see, and then once the secret is disclosed, then everybody says, I can't believe it. And now we see the Jekyll and Hyde. Mm-hmm. But how about a cult leader? How about Keith Raniere with Nixium?
Mm-hmm.
Here you have somebody that is absolutely using someone, but they will not only like it, they want to stay, and they'll pay money. They'll go out yes. and work for the cult leader, yep. and they yep. call them a family. So that is the highest degree of sophistication, and so that's the sophisticated psychopath.
Those who rise to the top in politics are really like cult leaders.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, people line up for this abuse.
That's right.
They'll vote
him back in office.
Yes.
Right. Biden says, I'll raise your taxes and you'll pay more. Like, think about right now. And again, whether Trump or Biden, it doesn't matter. Think about the concept that you've just been told about the policies that are going to do. Okay, that you're not going to have energy independence any longer. You're going to be dependent upon a foreign country. Therefore, right, by necessity, what's going to happen to your gasoline prices? What's going to happen to all your energy prices? What's going to happen to your food prices? What's going to happen to your taxes? The question is this: why would you vote for someone that's going to bring harm on you?
Yes.
They've cast a spell over you.
Yeah.
Or there's secondary gain somewhere and you're willing to, in one political party, as long as we can take the life of a preborn baby, even after birth, I'll pay whatever I need to pay. But if you're a radical feminist, the question I have is this: are you ever sleeping with a guy? Then why are you worried about abortion? But you should be worried about the same group of people that are saying that men can come into your private spaces, and Planned Parenthood now has left women. They're in favor of what? Men and women's underwear and drag coming into all your private spaces, doing away with women's sports. Why are they doing that? Because ultimately the guys, they don't care about the medals. What do they care about? They're coming into the washroom. They're coming into the locker rooms. They're coming into women's prisons. So the same group that is backing Planned Parenthood is the same group that's going to eradicate women and leave them as sex slaves. That's the only thing women are going to be good for in that same category. That's why they're in favor of pornography, the Democrat Party in favor of legalized prostitution, lowering age of consent, all debauched and debased stuff is found within that party. So why would any self-respecting woman be willing to vote for somebody from that party? They've either been schnookered or brainwashed. In the book of Galatians, mm-hmm, Paul asked this question to the Galatians. He says, who has bewitched you? Very powerful word, meaning,
yes,
what's come over you? You can't, yeah, see for looking. And that's the art of the most sophisticated of predators. It's Bill Clinton, right?
Yes.
Literally, figuratively, screws over Monica Lewinsky, but then steps in front of the camera and, mm-hmm, says, not only I did not have sex with that woman, but then does this. That's bad enough, right? It's going after our intuition, our reality testing. That's the only, without intuition, you have no reality testing. But then he doubles down on it and he flips the script. That's exactly what they're doing. And to say, I did not have sex with that woman and I am tired of this. I need to get back to the job, the American people. Clinton was classic, right, at taking a situation where he's totally busted and being able to flip it, where I'm not going to tolerate this any longer, this distraction, I'm getting back to the job that the American people voted me in.
Yeah.
Right? And before you know it, it's like, yeah, Bill, and they vote him back in.
Yeah.
So that's the art of the sophisticated psychopath. The chart you have in front of you is, it shows you how far down and how many knapsacks over time the sophisticated manipulator, predator, perpetrator, cult leader, sociopath, psychopath, all this. It's really, the best way to view it is selfishness by degree. And the, mm-hmm, more he can get away with it, and again, the greater the degree of finesse, his staying power, his longevity is greater. The more overt the manipulation, the more overt, meaning the more people can catch on, the less likely he's going to have success over the long run, because he's going to have to use additional tactics. So gaslighting, it's only successful because he's beating down, literally or figuratively, his wife. Let's say in that the actual movie Gaslighting,
mm-hmm,
he's creating a shell of a person. But before you know it, what happens? Somebody notices. Is it Ingrid Bergman? I forget who played it. No, my wife's going to. I forget the actress. But somebody noticed. Right. It's like, you're not the way you used to be. What happened to the old you?
Right.
So somebody's eventually going to notice. If somebody's being gaslit, they're eventually creating a Stepford wife kind of situation, a hollow shell of a person, still runs the risk, the family. And that's why that medium grade, lower level manipulator who's gaslighting, he's got to isolate the person away from everybody, including their own family. Because the family, people are beginning to notice that the person's becoming a shell of themselves, but the most sophisticated person will never do that because they're so winsome. So the wife is being manipulated, but she doesn't even know it. And she still will say he's the greatest husband in the world. Mm-hmm. That's sophisticated. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of like Bill, but you know, Hillary wanted to do a thing or two to him, but she was still willing to stand up and be seen on stage with him.
It's hard to even call that a marriage, but
yeah. that's right.
It was a political arrangement. There are a couple of things here. First of all, there's just no question that we're going to have at least a part two on psychopathy. But there was something that you said in the McCann interview about reprobate. We haven't gotten to that chart. I don't know if we have time to get to that big chart or if we should save it. But when you talked about reprobate as metallurgy, that was just an amazing thing to my mind.
You know what? Let's bring up the chart so people know what we're eventually get into. So, you know, my apologies to everybody, but hopefully those other charts set the stage for what they're now looking at.
Is it possible for you to make that chart bigger? Can you increase the size? I'm just curious.
You'll have to kind of tell me, is it increasing it?
It is. And if you can scroll up now, we can drag, you know, yeah, perfect.
Okay, great. I can see it on my end. You know, maybe I could have seen the chart on my end, so my apologies. Okay, so what we're looking at, as a matter of fact, let me decrease it just for a moment. Everybody watch their eyes. I want to show you the size of the chart just so you can see what we're going to be looking at. Okay, so now I'm going to increase it so we can read it. But where we're going also is, see all those little arrows, the tiny little arrows? It's going to show you the difference mm-hmm. between the impulsive versus the calculating psychopath. Okay, I'm going to increase this enough now so that we can read it. Watch your eyes. I'm going to scroll all the way up. Okay, hopefully now it makes sense why I took the time to describe the issue of conscience. Because mm-hmm. as goes conscience, so that's that red box across the top. This chart is designed to show the progression into sexual psychopathy. And the question is this, how do you create, or how does somebody become that way, where they're willing to become, or they end up becoming a sex offender? And not just a regular sex offender, that may sound funny, but there's different degrees of them, but a woman or a child's worst nightmare. Are they born that way? Is it nurture nature? Well, hopefully now I've been able to kind of set the stage to help people understand it's a progression. And potentially, here's the disconcerting thought. I'll just speak to us guys. Gentlemen, if you think you couldn't become like that, then the question is this. How did Germany become Nazi Germany in just a few years? And are you really so sure? So, meaning, are you sure you could, if you get into stuff long enough, you will. Now, maybe a guy's thing isn't sex and sexuality, but you let your ego go long enough. And I'll tell you what, money, sex, and power, those are three very powerful. David Foster wrote a book with that title. So, my contention is this. As goes the red, so goes the rest of this. But by the time, now you see in the green, those are going to be criminal charges. That by the time a guy is busted, those are the charges that have been layered on. He'll usually inevitably do a plea deal. But when I was working on psych staff in prison doing sex offender treatment, I should have mentioned that I do that. I've been doing that for 15 years now, 11 years in the prison system working with sex offenders. And now I'm a provider out in the community, one of South Carolina's larger providers. By the time they're busted and have those charges, trust me, they're further to the right than the charges indicate. And by the time they're in prison, they've done plea deals. So you can have somebody that's really far right that was charged with stuff over on the left in that category. How you read this chart also is the dotted blue vertical line that separates legal from illegal. So everything to the left of that line is legal, everything to the right. And we know based upon how societies work, and Kinsey was a great example of that, we can shift that line. or make it disappear altogether. The Roman Empire probably had very, you know, it would probably be the opposite. Kinsey moved the line to the left. So where we are now in terms of criminal offenses, what used to be the case if somebody had harmed a child versus now what it is, we can thank Kinsey for that. So, and if it, you know, left up to certain political parties, there would be no blue line. How about this? Minor attracted persons. What is that? That's a rebranding or reframing of a pedophile. Now they want to say that pedophiles really are born that way. James Cantor is one that is pushing that. That's why they, he wants to add the P, pedophile, to the growing list of LGBTQ plus. And why? Because they don't want these people, once they're busted, to do jail time. They want them into treatment. And James Cantor happens to have a treatment program, very interesting. So the guys can be diverted into treatment. So he has monetary incentive as well. Plus, these guys know, and they'll say, well, you can have virtuous or non-offending pedophiles. And I say, really, how do you know that? James Cantor's response was, he would know if they're offending. Really? I've been doing this a long time and I don't know. Plus, I have more access to information than Cantor does. And how many of my guys, it's unbelievable. I get word from their probation officer that he was busted when they did a search and they found a second phone. And unless you can follow these guys 24/7, you don't know what they're doing and you don't know what they're accessing online, because every one of them will tell you what, I'm being good, Mr. Euler. So if your research into psychopaths, especially sexual psychopaths, depend upon self-reports of the men that you are studying, you are being schnookered and you're a useful idiot to them. One simple way to test that is how many pedophiles that got busted turned themselves in prior to getting busted. No, they all wait until what? They get busted. Why? And how long were they perping prior to getting busted? For years. So the day before arrest, the pedophile will tell you he's not offending. So again, it really matters how you do research on pedophiles. And now pedophiles love the idea that, oh, that myth that they were just reenacting their own abuse. That is not true. The sophisticated perps were never perped on. How do you know? Because true survivors become protective, not exploitive. If you want to do research on the survivors of sexual abuse in prison, you don't go to the sex offender treatment unit, you go to the drug and alcohol unit. Because they've been numbing out their pain, and those are the inmates that want to beat the tar out of the pedophiles.
Right.
Okay. So continuing on, and then we will maybe pick up part two. How you read this, here's, and we'll go through this kind of in depth, but here's the list of different charges. And if we were to draw white, can't do it right here, but if I were to draw white vertical lines, they would really match as far as categories. If we were to go down to the gold bar down here, continuum of sexual objectification, predation, and perpetration. Predation means the predator, that this is where the calculating part comes in. See the different boxes or the different categories, left, self-gratification, self-entitlement. You see they're divided by a little box. If you were to do a vertical line stretching all the way up and down, and maybe for the next time we meet, I'll have a chart that already has that in there. That's the best way to view this. So there's about 10 different categories of guys. And how this pertains is, as I'm working with guys that have perpetrated sex offenses, hopefully you can see, depending upon when they got busted, right? You could have some guy that got busted, or by the time he was busted, he was just in the self, not just, but he's in the self-gratification category. That's going to take a different degree of focus and approach with that guy than the guy that's all the way down on the far right, deviant passion and possession. Very different. And especially the key is understanding the difference between lust and self-gratification and deviance. And in a nutshell, but we'll go into this next time, where a normal man can only get an erection once he, or an a normal man, and I'm not saying these guys are normal, but if a guy gets into lust, here's what's going to happen. He will still only be able to get and maintain an erection to the extent that he knows that his partner or the person that he's with is enjoying him or herself, is along with them. That's a normal man, but the moment the mood is lost or changed, he'll lose the erection. Some man who's deviant can only get an erection to the extent that he knows that he is generating harm or the person that he's with is experiencing harm, pain, or trauma. That's what the deviant person is getting off on. They're no longer human. The further they go, the less human they are. They are a predator. And so that's why, by the way, castration will not decrease the likelihood of sex offending, especially with pedophiles, because pedophiles are over on the far right and men use objects. It shows you it's not sexual gratification. So there we go.
So the gratification is coming from inflicting harm.
Correct. There we go. From traumatizing. And that is so crucial. And we can get into that next time.
Well, if we can just a little teaser for next time. We're looking at a chart here that We're looking at a chart that shows the progression of the reprobate. And I heard you say in the other interview that I've referenced that reprobate comes from the root word, was it?
That's right. And if you want to see the most often used or when people use it a lot, it actually comes out of the New Testament, Romans chapter 1. Paul's sitting down, he's writing a description of kind of this process when someone's going downhill. And he was trying to, I'm reading into it, but if you're sitting down writing something, you're choosing your words precisely. He chose a word that comes from metallurgy.
I'm sorry, John, but that blew my mind.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
So it's a non-religious term. And so this term, it's like, so it has to do with the integrity of the metal. And so if we were building a bridge, fortunately I don't, and the people that have to drive across bridges are fortunate that I'm not an engineer, but from what I hear, so let's say a load of steel is brought to the work site. But let's say an engineer is testing and says, whoa, hold on. Something happened to this batch. We're not going to take this I-beam and use it because it's not going to hold up. Mm-hmm. So what they would do back in the day, if they stamped these kind of things, but let's say they would stamp the word reprobate. And nobody's going to use it because it's no longer good for its intended purpose. The human mind, the way it was created, was intended to have a high view of people and a low view of things in terms of value. So our mind is created to think God's thoughts, especially when it comes to people and their value and the appreciation of them and the issue of boundaries. So if someone has a high view of people, they will not cross boundaries. They won't use them. But the more I become selfish, the more reprobate I become, which is that process, and it's a twisting effect. Eventually, I'll go from understanding right, wrong, good, bad. That becomes inverted. And then I change from loving people and using things to, now it gets inverted, like a fighter jet going into a cloud bank and it inverts, where I used to love people and use things. I now love things and use people, and I will line up at Walmart on Black Friday, and I will trample people to get a TV that I don't need just because. Mm-hmm. And that is a reprobate mind. A sexual reprobate is one that will, now you layer sexuality over it, and now it will use people, but it's also going dark. And that's where you get into the deviance. So it's no longer about sex and sexuality. It's about the kind of harm and negative impact that I can inflict upon someone. And that's why they become a predator.
So I'm conscious of the time, and we have arrived at the end. I wanted to say about metallurgy. This blew my mind because this ancient deviant priesthood also are sometimes referred to as alchemists. And remaking what was, they say God's creation was imperfect. They want to remake that which was left imperfect in their eyes. They are alchemists practicing alchemy on humankind. We are their prey.
There you go.
And it's just fascinating to me that the reprobate, another way of saying it, is they're working with the metal of humankind, remaking it in their deviant image.
That's right. And they'll use people. That's right.
I'm so appreciative of your time. I was looking forward to this, and I thank you for doing this with me. And I will send you an email and try to get a part two. I conceived of this wrongly. I thought we could do this, and then we could get into the trans, and then we can wrap it. And, you know, it's three and out, okay? I think that I need more time with the sexual predator, the psychopath, and so we'll book in another little session there. And I thank you again for doing this with me.
More than welcome, and it's a pleasure.
All right, and thank you. And so that was John, and I will be back next week with another guest. I also wanted to comment, I just love the image or sculpture there, pulling someone out of the abyss.
Oh, yeah.
It's very nice.
That's compliments of my wife.
Oh.
She's got a little sculpture there.
Very nice. Okay, John, thanks so much.
You bet.
I've got something that the world didn't give me, and the world cannot take it away. And I've got something that the world didn't give me, and the world cannot take it away. Well, it is love, sweet love, oh, sent to me from my Father up above.